This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. When the pandemic first hit, a lot of people started to work from home, and with that came the idea of getting a pet. Now, as things are going slowly back to normal, are folks second-guessing that decision, and how is that affecting shelters? We're going to discuss these topics and more. With us now, we have Katie Trinipool, the Deputy Director of the Indianapolis Animal Care Services, and David Horth, CEO of Indy Humane. Welcome both of you to the program. Katie, what is happening right now at the IACS shelter?
Yeah, so as people are returning to work, we are seeing things go back to normal at the shelter as far as intakes. So we're seeing intakes back to numbers closer to where we were in 2019, which includes the typical seasonal increase of stray dogs and cats and kittens. So we're definitely seeing that, but we're also seeing that adoptions are lower than they've been in quite a few years. And I think, you know, a lot of that has to do with people being able to travel for the first time in a long time. But it's definitely causing some bottlenecks for the shelter.
Mm-hmm. And when you mentioned the seasonal stray cats and dogs, what is that about?
Yeah, so in the sheltering world, we have what's known as kitten season, where we're seeing a lot of kittens being born outdoors, and then those kittens end up at the shelter along with mom, hopefully, so that they can go into foster and be adopted out later. So, you know, it's something that happens when the weather gets warmer, cats start mating, more kittens are born, usually in the late spring, and then cats can have multiple litters a year, so this will go on until about October. And then in the winter, we typically see our cat intakes decline.
Mm-hmm. And David, sort of a similar question for you about Indy Humane Shelters. What's the latest right now?
Much the same in many ways. We're trying to move back toward normalcy from the pandemic. We were a much smaller shelter during the pandemic by necessity, and we're growing back into our previous capacities and moving back toward opening back up to the public for open adoptions. We were doing adoptions and still are doing adoptions by appointment only, out of respect for the pandemic and social separation and all of those issues. So much like Katie, we're seeing a reduced adoptions. The demand for adoptions through the summer months is usually quite high, and that demand isn't present right now. And I agree with her. It's because people are moving back to normal, and they're vacationing, and they're going back to work at their office, and their lives are changing. So they're not prioritizing adoption at this time.
Mm-hmm. Well, with adoptions going down, are you finding that the shelters are fuller now?
Yes.
Okay.
I can only speak for Indy Humane. I'm sorry, but yeah, we're fuller than we would like to be. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And Katie, is that the same for you?
Yeah, I would agree with that. We have tried to be strategic in the animals that we're taking in, and really trying to get the message out to the public that if an animal doesn't have to come to the shelter, it shouldn't come to the shelter, because it takes up the cage for the next animal that does have to come in. The fact is, you know, all shelters have limited resources, whether it be cage space, whether it be finances to care for the animals or staff to care for the animals. We can't just continue to take animals in without, you know, a place for them to go. And sadly, if we aren't adopting out animals at the same rate, and our rescue partners aren't adopting out animals at the same rate, that really limits the options and requires us to euthanize animals. So definitely want people to know, if an animal doesn't have to come to the shelter, we can help with support to keep the animal out.
Right. Well, at the beginning of the pandemic, there was, or at least that's what I've heard, and I've seen some articles about a demand for animals and pets. Did that seem more than usual during the pandemic? Did you see a lot more people coming in to get pets?
So what we saw at IACS, we shut down our intake for non-emergency situations. So obviously, if an animal was being aggressive, an animal was sick or injured, an animal was in danger, we were still taking it in. But just a friendly owner surrender, we were really encouraging owners to find other resources for those animals. So our intake was down significantly in 2020. So our adoptions declined declined because of that. Now, as a percentage of our intakes, adoptions were pretty steady, but it did seem like there were more adoptions just because we had more space in the shelter. And we did that because we didn't know, you know, if people were going to be hospitalized and need a place for their pets, or what we would do if we had an outbreak among our staff. You know, early in the pandemic, there were a lot of unknowns.
Right, right. Well, David, did you notice any increase in adoptions at Indy Humane at the start of the pandemic? Was this something everybody was trying to do?
Yeah, we did notice an increase in adoptions, and the biggest increase we noticed was in foster care. We did an emergency plea for foster homes, and several hundred people responded. So we were able to place a lot of animals in foster homes that we couldn't keep in our shelter at that time. There was a noticeable increase in adoptions at the very beginning of the pandemic, when people were sheltering in place. And frankly, there was an element of loneliness and things like that that pets can help with a lot. Mm-hmm. But the huge increase we saw was in foster care.
Right. And are you worried at all? I mean, I don't know if you've seen any changes yet of folks who, now that they're coming out of this lockdown and they're going back to work or traveling, they're bringing the animals that they adopted back.
Yeah, I think those stories have been pretty much disproven. I can speak for the Humane Society and tell you that we are not seeing any unusual returns or unusual levels of returns. I think the Humane Society of the United States did a national survey, and those stories didn't hold. Mm-hmm. I don't know about that, but I can tell you at the Humane Society that our return rates are very, very normal. They're not unusually high at all. They're not even high.
Right, right. And Katie, is it the same over at ACS?
Yeah, I will say we actually have seen a decrease in the number of animals returned. And I think a lot of that has to do with the appointment-based system that we've been doing for adoptions that allows us to be one-on-one with people and have conversations prior to adopting. I would also say, you know, adoption returns aren't always a bad thing. Sometimes the animal just isn't the right fit for that family. And so, you know, we don't consider a return a bad thing. We like to look at it more as an exchange so that we can find, you know, the right animal for the right family.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I fully agree with that. We have what we call a guilt-free return. We ask for information on why it didn't work out, but if they don't want to talk about it, we just take the animal back. It's not, no questions asked, because we'd rather have the animal than not.
Right. And you know, with the way the pandemic hit everybody in different industries, like how did it hit shelters? Were there things that you had to change at all?
Everything.
Mm-hmm. Everything. So
yeah, nothing remained the same. We were open adoption before, and then we went to adoptions by appointment only, which I agree with Katie is a much, much better system. It's a much more efficient system. It's more technology dependent than open adoptions. But I really can't think of anything at the Humane Society that didn't change as a result of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. And what about you, Katie?
I would agree with that. So we moved to the appointment-based adoptions, but also prior to the pandemic, we were really trying to get the public on board with intake by appointment. So if an animal needed to come to the shelter, scheduling an appointment, and then the pandemic really forced that. So we have moved to that, and that has been a game changer for us to be able to manage the flow of animals through the building. And provide much better care for the animals that we do take in. So exactly. That has been one positive for us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And a question that I have just in general, in terms of if you find a stray animal, for example, I know sometimes people wonder what they should be doing. Should they be taking these animals to animal shelters, or should they just leave them alone outside?
It depends on the situation. So for cats, we have really progressive community cat ordinances in Indianapolis. So a stray cat is allowed to be out if it's unowned. So the caveat there is that the cat has to be spayed or neutered. So you can contact any local cat group. Indy Neighborhood Cats is a really good resource for community cats. They have a Facebook page. page. They have a website, and they have lots of information for what to do if you find a stray cat. If that cat does come to the shelter, what we're going to do is we're going to get it spayed or neutered. We're going to get an ear tip on the cat, which is the universal sign that it has been spayed or neutered. And then we're going to put the cat right back out where it was found. And the purpose of that is that multiple studies have been done to show that cats are significantly more likely to find their own way back home than they are to wait for their owners to come to the shelter and find them. So there are also negatives to removing a cat from an area if they're already in that area, including that other cats will come in and they're just going to breed to the capacity of that area. Mm-hmm. So it's actually going to create more cats if you just continue to remove them.
Right.
So cats are a little bit different than dogs. With dogs, if you find a stray dog and you can hold on to it, that's the ideal situation. So Indy Humane runs a program called Indy Lost Pet Alert that was a game changer for animal welfare in Indianapolis. And it is a lost and found resource for pet owners. I have no idea how many animals get posted there annually, but it is a lot. And it helps, it'll help the finder create a flyer for the pet that they found. They can share that on social media. They can print that off. Definitely encourage you to share it on Nextdoor, to share on your neighborhood Facebook pages, your own social media, and really get the word out. Because the fact is, most dogs are going to stay within a mile, or less of where they live. So if you take that animal and you bring them all the way across the county to the shelter, you're really making it harder to get that animal back home to the owner. A lot of people don't understand the difference between IACS and Indy Humane, or they don't even know that IACS exists. So by the time that that animal's 4-day stray hold is up, a lot of owners may not have even thought to look at the animal shelter for that animal. If they did, they may not have transportation to get to the animal shelter. They might not be able to adjust their work schedule to get to the shelter. And then that forces us to find an outcome for an animal that already has an owner and a family that loves it. So the best thing to do for that dog is to keep it in the area where it was found.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both for your time. Katie Trinipool is the Deputy Director of the Indianapolis Animal Care Services, and David Horth is the CEO of Indy Humane. After the break, we'll talk about how the history and culture of the local LGBTQ community is preserved in Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Preserving history can be a difficult feat, and today we're talking about how the history of the LGBTQ community in Indiana has been kept alive and available for the public to see. If you have any questions or comments for the show today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. We're joined now by Eric Mundell, the Director of Collections Management at the Indiana Historical Society. Welcome, Eric. I want to start with why it's important to preserve the history of Indiana.
Well, it's very important because we're addressing the LGBTQ concerns today. The collecting of that material had been fairly non-existent in many respects until it kind of all came to fall into place. We like to look back and reflect on Indiana history because it's important to preserve our heritage. And that begins at every level and with every community. So we began to address that in 2014 at the Indiana Historical Society with an LGBTQ collecting initiative. We found that we had so very little in the collection other than a few books. And that was a very overlooked and part of our history. So we needed to catch up, so to speak. We mm-hmm. really began to take a close look at that. So in 2014, we began that initiative under our former CEO, John Herbst, looking to fill the gaps in some of our history. And that was just one of the beginning points. We began with LGBTQ materials. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Well, what spurred that recognition in 2014?
Well, it was already in front of our very eyes, and we said we can't let this go on any longer. We really need to fill in all of those gaps in history. And we're working on that in very many respects. But that one initiative with the LGBTQ community was where we wanted to start. And so we addressed that, and we got our first collection from a donor who wanted to spur that on. And we had something to say, here, we've got a collection going. And then we were able to open that up, get a lot more press on that, so to speak. And we set up a two-year program to gather oral histories of individuals, of couples, of people in the community from all around the state. And we also had a very talented photographer and interviewer, Mark Lee, who we hired to do that job over a two-year period. And he first started with Central Indiana, conducting those interviews, taking photographs, recording video of his interviews with those individuals and couples. And then he spread that out to the rest of the state. So we did that kind of in increments and gradually collected this material statewide.
Wow, that's fascinating. So you were able to get it for all of the state, not just certain locations like Indianapolis.
Yeah, I mean, it was harder to reach out to some other parts of the state. We did our best. Getting other people outside of urban communities to participate was a little more challenging, but we certainly addressed it, and we welcome more material from other individuals and groups and organizations from all over the state. That's what we're about. We're about all of Indiana's history.
And how you mentioned like the oral histories and the photographs. How else does the Indiana Historical Society preserve history and culture, and in particular when it comes to the LGBTQ community? Are you having exhibits or anything?
We have had exhibits. We had a large opening exhibit after the initiative was launched, and we based a lot of that first exhibition on the photographs of Mark Lee, who had done that work for us. And we incorporate that into every way we look at how we do programming exhibitions. We've had many events. We've hosted all kinds of activities here under that umbrella. And you know, quite often in June, because it is Pride Month, so we do look at that. It's been a little more impacted last year and this year, but we hope to get back to doing more of that in the future, I'm sure. And when it's not just online.
Mm-hmm. And I know you also do archiving and you keep that side of history as well. Can you tell us about the Chris Gonzalez Archive?
Yes, we are primarily a paper-based institution. So we're collecting the documentation, the letters, journals, diaries, photographs, any of the, you know, the documentary archival types of materials that people would be looking for to preserve that, to recognize that history and to study it. So we have gathered these materials, and the Chris Gonzalez collection is just one of those. We formally call it the Michael Bohr Collection of the Indiana Pride Chris Gonzalez Library and Archives. We've kind of got a very large name for that collection because it does have a very deep history with both the individual who began collecting it and with its association with Indy Pride and giving it the name memorializing the contributions of Chris Gonzalez. So it's a really big and broad collection, and it was just outstanding that we were able to get it here to preserve and make available.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you tell us a little bit about Chris Gonzalez and the significance of this?
Yeah. Now, the significance that it's in name in memory of Chris Gonzalez, who was founder of the Indiana Youth Group. And so he had passed away in the 1990s. And this was just about the time the library and archives was coming about. There was a gentleman named Michael Bohr, who has been long established in the LGBTQ community, and he's long had his pulse on the community since the 1970s. Mike Bohr started the collection of all kinds of materials. He started with books and videos and other things, but it broadened into collecting all kinds of paper materials and documentation and photographs of the LGBT community from around the state, and in particular in certain aspects of the community. He was really, he had the goal of modeling collection after what the Gerber Library in Chicago had established. It's a very, very famous LGBTQ center there for the history of Chicago area. And so there was an opportunity in the early 1990s, a group called Diversity Incorporated was established, and they had a presence on Massachusetts Avenue. There was a rented storefront. And so the collection that Mike Bohr had gathered was able to go there. Now, when they were looking to assign a name that would attract, more of a broader scope and more interest in what Mike had collected all those years, and when Diversity Incorporated was founded, they wanted to recognize Chris Gonzalez for the many contributions he had established in working with the Indiana Youth Group and being a very solid presence throughout the LGBTQ community. And the Diversity Center moved from Massachusetts Avenue to a much larger facility on Southeastern Avenue. So they had a full-scale operation there, and the library itself, everything that Mike Bohr had gathered, moved there. That broadened the interest, that incorporated a lot more activity and people coming to the center. And so more donations were contributed over the year to broaden that collection that now had the Chris Gonzalez name attached to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Eric Mundell right now, Director of Collections Management at the Indiana Historical Society, and learning more about the history of the LGBTQ community here in Indiana. Eric, I'm curious, what can people see in the collection? I know you mentioned you're sort of a paper-based archive. Are these photographs and I don't know, writings? What can people see in the Chris Gonzalez
collection? Yes, we have broad coverage, and throughout we've had the initiative going on for quite some time, and we have literally into the hundreds of materials have been contributed. In addition to all the material that's in the Chris Gonzalez collection, that focuses on a lot of activities such as AIDS and the Damien Center, politics, marriage equality. It has material on the youth group, Indiana Youth Group. There are a wide variety of periodicals. About everything you can think of in the gay press is in there. And there's a very distinct element of drag featured. The Bag Ladies are prominent in the collection, as well as an interesting collection from a couple named Bob and Margaret Green. And the Greens went around. They were big fans of drag shows, and so they went all over and captured that photographically. And so we've got the collection. And those are some of the things that fall under the umbrella of the Chris Gonzalez collection. And then in addition, we've collected broadly from within the community and around the state. We have the Indianapolis Men's Chorus and Crossroads Performing Arts materials. We have digital images. We've had, after we got the initial Chris Gonzalez library materials, we had an addition to that. And we have individuals such as Mary Byrne, who is very prominent in the community and has since moved out of the state. And Mary was active in the Women's Music Festival. She had a bookstore. She operated women's and lesbian nightclubs. So she had her hands in a lot of activities, and we got her collection material, as well as there was another couple that owned a bookstore, Harriet Clare and Becky Thacker, who operated Dreams and Swords. They not only gave us some of their personal papers, but also gave us material from the store itself. So we've had wonderful individuals contributing a variety of things, and we look forward to more of that coming.
Well, is this stuff available for folks to look at online, or would they have to come in into the center?
Yeah. Excellent point. Thank you for asking that question. Most of the collections that have not been digitized would be available to come in. You make an appointment to come to the library. We bring that down for you from our storage area, and you see that in the comfort of our reading room, and you can ask for anything that you want to. When we catalog a collection, when we process material we make it available both electronically through a cataloging record, but we also have a collection guide there. So you can look at that collection guide, for example, the Michael Bohr collection and Mindy Pride and Chris Gonzalez Library Archives collection is massive. And we've got a big collection guide to that, which people can see online. They can determine which box, which folder, whatever element of that collection they want to see. They can make that decision in advance and say, that's exactly what I'd like to look at. We'll make that appointment and they can come and see the material. Otherwise, we do have a lot of things that we have digitized. We've been pretty strong about getting digital materials up from these representative collections that we've gathered from the past 7 years. And so you can go to our website and look under the digital images.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I know we touched upon this a little bit earlier about the importance of having these kinds of collections and archives. For people that are just tuning in, tell us why it's really important to have stuff like this, preserving this history.
It's so important. Sometimes people don't realize the value of the things they have. And you know, there may be things that other people have collected similarly, if you've got the same journals or periodicals that you picked up at a nightclub or whatever. But the things that are particularly unique to tell your story, we are Indiana's storyteller at the Indiana Historical Society. So every person, every organization, every group out there that has connections to the LGBTQ community have something to tell, and they have a history that's worth preserving. Because if we don't look at that, how are we going to find out about that in the future? We need to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've had a past guest from your organization on before to talk about the history of the AAPI community in Indiana, and it seems that we're hearing more conversations about diversity and inclusion in history. Is that something you're seeing in historical circles when it comes to preserving stories, or has it always been that way?
I think we were definitely seeing an upswing of that. I wouldn't say that it's always been that way, but we are looking always more diversely every place we can. And the only setback to that is just not having enough people to participate, enough people to contribute. So that's the only place where we might have any sort of lack of interest. We're pursuing every avenue we can in that respect to broaden diversity. And so that's what we're all about.
Mm-hmm. And how do you decide which collections to carry? Is there a process in deciding like what you're going to exhibit and what you're going to put in the archives?
Well, the library and archives here at the Historical Society, we like to say is the center. That's the heart of what we do. It's one of the longest, historically, it's one of the longest activities that has gone on here at the Indiana Historical Society. And we've broadened, you know, we didn't used to do exhibits. We didn't used to do a lot of the things that we do now. We've broadened that scope. And what was always there at the heart was the library and archives that we have, because that is the material you draw on to tell those stories, to craft exhibitions, and to develop that storyline. So we do a lot of that based entirely on our collection. But if we don't have any material to support that, then we might borrow things from other institutions or do that graphically. So our exhibition team, you know, does amazing work at creatively pulling that all together.
Well, as we get ready to wrap up here, I'm curious if there's anything interesting or overlooked that folks might not know when it comes to the history of the LGBTQ community here in Indiana that you were able to uncover through the archiving process.
Well, I'm giving that some thought, because that wasn't a question I had thought of. There's one collection here that I had kind of highlighted on a list of collections I have. It's interesting to me. There was a couple here in Indiana. It was the first male couple to be married legally in Greene County, Indiana. And their names are Timothy J. and Tracy D. Brown Salzman. They have an interesting story in that it took them three tries to get their marriage confirmed, because there were problems with how the license was issued. There were mistakes made as to Tracy's gender. They kind of went through some hurdles before they finally got the right license. And so in the collection they donated to us, we have all three licenses that they had to fill out before they finally had the most accurate and legal record of their marriage. And so that's kind of a fun story and one that's a little more obscure. So.
Well, thank you so much for sharing. We really appreciate it. And thank you for taking the time to join us today. Eric Mundell is the Director of Collections Management at the Indiana Historical Society. We'll be back after a quick break. We're going to be speaking with some leaders in the LGBTQ community to find out more about the community's history here in Indiana. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881, or you can send us a voice message without making a call by using our smartphone app. It's called All In Vox Pop, free and easy to use. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. That's VOXPOP. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Before the break, we were talking about the preservation of Indiana's LGBTQ history through collections and archives. Now we're going to learn more about the history of the local LGBTQ community and pride in Indiana, as well as looking at how things have changed for the community in the last few decades. And as always, if you have any questions or comments, feel free to reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. We're joined now by Chris Hanberg, Executive Director of Indy Pride, and Randa Stefano, VP of Human Resources at the Indiana Youth Group. Welcome, both of you. Thank you for joining us today. Chris, let's start with the history of Pride in Indiana. How did that all come about?
Well, thank you so much for having me here today. It's great to be with you. We can trace back the origins of Pride to about 1981, and we had our first Pride event. And it was at a now gone hotel called the Essex Hotel, which is what was on the Circle. And it was a dinner where people were nervous and scared to go. And some of them wore masks walking into the hotel where they had this dinner. And then a year later, they decided to have a Labor Day picnic at Westlake Park with over 500 people. And one of the events that I love at Indy Pride is we continue the tradition of a community picnic every year, with the exception of last year because of the pandemic. And then we saw in the 1980s these events where people sort of gathered privately and did not announce it publicly, didn't have a Facebook page in the 1980s to announce their events. But they started to gather and build community. And it wasn't until 1990 that we had a first public that was open to the public event on the Circle called Celebration on the Circle. And then from there, the Pride event was really born, and it grew through the work of several grassroots organizations that all came together to form Indy Pride in 1995.
Well, did Indy Pride follow any trajectories of other states, or, I mean, were these all happening simultaneously, or was Indiana sort of on its own?
Indiana was sort of on its own. There wasn't a lot of communication that I'm aware of across Pride leadership. You know, now we have international and national Pride organizations where, you know, we do work with Miami Pride and Fort Lauderdale Pride and all of the different Pride organizations across the states. We even hosted an international group of Pride organizations in 2017 to get together for their annual meeting and discuss issues in the community and the direction we'd like to go. But at that time, I think that folks were just using the networks they had, and they were pretty much on their own.
Mm-hmm. And Ran, what would you say, you know, if you're looking over the years, the way Pride celebrations have changed, have you seen anything growing or getting better, or is there still a lot of work to be done?
Well, thank you for having me. There is still a lot of work to be done, but there's been a huge amount of progress. And having been at the events that Chris was just talking about, except for the dinner in 1981. You know, I came out in 1985 and I got involved with Indiana Youth Group as a member in the late 80s. So, you know, Indiana Youth Group was at those Pride picnics at Westlake Park, he mentioned, and certainly at the two events, Celebration on the Circle, that was also mentioned in 1990 and 1991. After that, as Chris knows, we moved to a different setting and, you know, it just kept growing and getting bigger. And the good news is we eventually got corporate sponsorship, which is always nice to have the support of others in the community. So there's been a lot of progress, but yes, there's still ways to go, especially in achieving full equality.
Mm-hmm. And for you personally, Rand, I'm curious, like what has it been like for you to see the early days of this to how it's come together now? Did you ever think you'd see the changes that have come about?
Well, not in my lifetime, as far as marriage equality. I certainly never thought I would see that. And of course, I'm very glad to see it. As far as Pride itself, you know, it's just been such changes. And it, just even having a parade, I remember years ago going to Chicago, who had, you know, of course, a parade long before we did. And I didn't know if we'd ever have that. So, you know, I'm very proud of people and organizations who helped get us to this point. I think it's also important to remember where we started, and that's the whole thing with history, is remembering those things that happened and those people that got us here. And one of the things that I liked about the early years was it was so personal. And, you know, when we were on the circle, I think it's important to realize that that was a public space, or it is a public space. It was open to anyone, and we certainly had protesters that came in with some very hateful signs from a local church and probably others as well. And, you know, at one point they tried to storm the stage and take over the mic. So we didn't let that happen. But it was very interesting. You know, it was interesting to be there and see that. And that's one of the reasons I started the Facebook page for Central Indiana LGBTQ History a year and a half ago, because I couldn't find one good spot where people could contribute memories, articles, posts, pictures, etc. So history is very important to document.
Mm-hmm. And Chris, how has Pride in Indiana grown to what it is now? What are some of the, I guess, differences now if you looked back 10 years?
Well, I think right now it's there is a greater amount of acceptance. A lot of allies are showing up and participating. You know, when Pride sort of started, it was a protest. It was a protest against police brutality. It was a protest against a society telling us that we had to stay in the closet and stay hidden, or they would arrest us and put us in jail. And then it evolved in Indiana to be a safe space where people could get to know people that were just like them. And for LGBTQ folks, especially those that live in red states like in Indiana, or may live in rural areas, you're not really around people that are like you that often, or at least in great number. And so that was a really important time for the community to build itself. And then from there, it sort of evolved into this place where you could be yourself, but also regroup, because we were coming out of the closet. And now we are at a place where, even as Rand mentioned, corporations embrace us. 15 years ago, 10 years ago, there were a lot of corporations who would, if a Pride organization approached them about sponsorship, about putting your name on something and donating money to the cause, there would be a lot of internal debate. Sometimes they'd say yes, sometimes they'd say no. And now we're in a different spot where it would be very difficult for a corporation to explain why they don't acknowledge Pride, mm-hmm. why they don't acknowledge our lives, our love, our humanity. To me, that's progress. There are some in our community that say that it's pretty vacant and that they're just showing up because they want to sell us stuff. But I look at it in the, you know, more optimistic view of, hey, they want to sell us stuff. And we are now achieved a level of equality that was not there in the past.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to ask you about that with corporations and companies sponsoring, or I feel like I saw something about the controversy of places where they're selling shirts for Pride and gear, and it's like, oh, now you want to sell this stuff. So you're saying you welcome that? You don't feel like people are sort of co-opting it?
I think there's a delicate balance between co-opting it and supporting. I know that Indy Pride pulls together a group called the Employee Resource Group, Business Resource Group, Pride Group, every other month. And it's for any company that's in Indianapolis to send representatives to discuss LGBTQ issues in the workplace, to discuss, you know, how they can support their LGBTQ employees and how can they highlight and honor folks. And for those people, and most of them are part of our community, it's a real source of pride that their company will sponsor financially Pride organizations, that they will make a special shirt and walk in the parade or buy a float and participate in Pride events. And so for the individuals that work there, it's their workplace that's supporting them. As far as, you know, selling stuff and rainbow washing things, you know, I think that is a case by case basis. But I know it makes me really happy when I can go into a store and see that I'm being honored, that our community is being honored. And so I might buy a cheap rainbow plate or a T-shirt because there were times when I was feeling ashamed to even go to a gay bar, let alone go to a store with my husband.
Mm-hmm. And Rand, what are your thoughts? Do you feel similarly about that?
I do. I think it is a balance. And I was in Meijer that I go to all the time recently. And for the first time in probably the 20 years I've been going to that Meijer, they had a Pride display of shirts and other things. So I do appreciate that. I think there is, of course, a corporate element to it. And it's not just out of the goodness of the store's heart. But I'm like Chris, I appreciate seeing it. And I think that for, you know, especially youth to see things like that, it's so important that they realize that they're not alone. I mean, you know, 34 years ago when Indiana Youth Group was founded, we would have never seen anything like that. I mean, I was a youth in some of the early years, and it's amazing what all we have accomplished, and that IYG is still here 34 years later doing good work for youth. But yeah, to be able to see that is important to our community, I believe.
Well, I do want to talk to you, Rand, about Indiana Youth Group. What's the importance of the group, and you know, what was your involvement with it?
Well, as I said, I started with Indiana Youth Group in the late 80s, and I was a youth myself at that time, and so that's what I was there as a member. And you know, the big thing back then was education and support, because we didn't, as Chris said, those many years ago, we didn't have Facebook, we didn't have cell phones or apps to find other people like ourselves. So when people would call the Gay and Lesbian Switchboard, which was a volunteer organization at the time, they were very little, you know, ways that or places even that they could be sent to, and I mean youth. So that's where Chris Gonzalez, who was mentioned earlier, comes in. Him and Pat Jordan and Jeff Werner, his partner, realized that there was very little they could offer to youth. So they went ahead, Chris and Jeff, with Pat's help, founded Indiana Youth Group, or as it was called back then, Indianapolis Youth Group. And the rest is history. So back then, as I said, they focused on AIDS education, safer sex. Of course, like I said, support and social. The social aspect was so important because finally, you know, you could be a gay youth and find other people like yourselves. And it was not easy back then to do that. And then moving to today, you know, when I came back to IYG in 2019 to assume the role of the HR person there, which I'm very glad to be back, I saw how IYG had evolved. And so now we provide basic needs, so food, clothing, helping with shelter, laundry facilities, even the shower facilities are available if somebody happens to need a shower. But they also do things like case management, and we do things like a project called Project Prism, which is helping to get homeless youth from 18 to 24 off the streets or out of housing insecurity and into housing and becoming self-sufficient. That just started in October through a federal grant that came through the city of Indianapolis, and we were one of three recipients for that. And then we do programming itself, which could be anything from photography club to accepting yourself and knowing your own identity and dealing with all the things that come with that. So I think that, you know, it's been very important. And also I would just add, moving to our building at 3733 North Meridian has been a huge help. We did that at the end of 2017, and that has really increased the space we have, put us right in the middle of, you know, close to downtown on a central street and on the bus line, and it allows more youth and individuals to get involved. And we've been very happy with that new location and increased space.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for sharing that. And Chris, when it comes to support for Pride in Indiana overall, do you think the state is more supportive of efforts?
Oh, I think that there's a lot of individuals within the state that are very supportive of the work that we do. I think that even I think it was this week that a Gallup poll was released that a majority of Republicans for the first time support marriage equality. So I think that we are still making progress. We're also seeing the most anti-LGBTQ legislation across the country targeting trans folks. And we were seeing some of those in Indiana. Fortunately, we've been able to stave off some of those, but we are seeing a pushback, especially for our trans and non-binary communities.
Right. And is there anything being done to combat some of those efforts?
I think there's a lot of people that are organizing. I know that there's here in Indiana that work behind the scenes and work publicly to influence, to talk and talk about how these bills target people, that they are not an abstraction. They're not a boogeyman. It is you are targeting the real lives of children who are trans. You are targeting the real lives of adults who are trans. And that has consequences for the mental, physical health of those folks. So yes, there is work being done, but you can always join in when you see those calls to action during legislative sessions.
Well, I do want to touch on Pride right before we wrap up here. And looking ahead, I think you already had celebrations this year. What is planned for the coming years?
Absolutely. So we just had our virtual festival. This was our second virtual festival. We really felt like the safest option and the amount of planning that would go into a huge festival, it was safer to do a virtual festival. But we had about 35,000 people participate in that on Saturday. And those do live on our Facebook page and on our website. We're hopeful. We're very, very hopeful for a parade on October 2nd. We're just sort of waiting for guidance from the health department about large gatherings in public. But once we receive that, our team is already working on the parade for October 2nd. And we'll also be doing a Rainbow 5K in the fall, as well as another big event that I can't quite tell you about yet because it's not public knowledge yet. But be on the lookout on IndyPride.org and our Facebook page at IndyPride, and you will hear some really exciting news about preserving the history of LGBTQ people.
You can't even give us a little hint?
It really does tie into, it ties into the circle, and that's okay. All I'm going to say.
All right. Well, thank you for that. We have about a minute left. Ran, is there any resources or anything you can offer listeners who may be looking to reach out to someone?
Yes, definitely. Well, we have a lot of great resources on our Indiana Youth Group website, so I would encourage people to visit that. I also sent that link to the station for your use. So I would really encourage people to check out our website and, of course, the other places that are listed on the resource guide itself. You know, Indiana Youth Group does so much and gives out a lot of information. We don't try to do it all ourselves. We're not experts in everything. So we work with a lot of partners and we do a lot of referrals and help those we can. And we focus on youth age 12 to 20, but other people can benefit from our services.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both so much for joining us this afternoon. Chris Handberg, Executive Director of Indy Pride, and Randa Stefano, VP of Human Resources at Indiana Youth Group. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yace, and Scott Cameron is our Managing Editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Join us tomorrow for a conversation about the decline of local news across the country. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.